Well, welcome, and thank the committee for asking me, or Pete for asking me to come up and do this. My name's Chris, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Chris.
Up sobriety date, 20th of December 1990, and been sober since the first meeting. So it's always a pleasure to come and do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor said I should never say no to any AA request, and he holds me to that, and my wife holds me to that too sometimes. So, I hope you get something out of the weekend. I'm sure you will. I love doing this kind of stuff. Me and Pete have been doing this for a long time. We sort of met in AA and have been friends for 30-odd years, and we cut our teeth on doing exactly this, and we've sat in that position before where you guys are sitting and watched other people do exactly the same thing and inspired us, and I guess that's why I'm here, to try and inspire people to get this way of life that's been so freely given to me, so that you can then pass it on to others, because that's what it's all about, really. That's enough from me.
My name's Pete, I'm an alcoholic. And welcome everybody. I'm glad to be here. It's a privilege to sit here and do this with Chris. As Chris mentioned, we've done this a lot. We're not new to this format. The idea is that over the course of the weekend, everybody's going to get an opportunity to go through the steps, whether for the first time, a brief look, or to revisit them as an older sober member like Chris and myself. I'll be going through doing all the work that's going to be outlined on the weekend. I've sobriety date 15 June 1991, and my home group's a Melbourne men's group, and that's where we're at. Everybody's got a copy of the steps guide, if you like. I don't like workbook. I like the term steps guide. We'll be going through different aspects of the book. I'm really going to cherry pick bits and pieces out of the textbook as we go through. And if you ask me what's the important parts in the book, the important parts in the book, well, from the front page to the end of 164 and include the appendices, is all important. But we're not going to have time to go through that amount of information. And other people would sit here and probably, well, I would have done this and I would have done that. But look, I'm just going to jump around all over the place. The handout, the work, the guide will be a great document that Chris and I will really lean on during the weekend. 85% of it is probably word for word from the textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous. So there's going to be certain steps that we may just use that guide to go with, because it is actually straight out of the textbook. and it might make it easier when we get around different steps. Tonight we want to try and cover the information for the first three steps, and tomorrow morning we'll do a group third step prayer together after breakfast. I thought I would invite everybody to start this weekend with a prayer. And at the top of that prayer sheet is the set-aside prayer. And I think that it might be a good way, especially for me, to try and start the weekend for me and everybody else. And if we want to join in together and we say that set-aside prayer together, it goes like this. God, please set aside everything I know about myself, the steps, the people, sobriety in you. Please help me to have an open mind so I may have a new experience in this. So that's the object of the exercise, is to have a new experience and discover the truth. Anybody that's new and hasn't been through this process before, please just have this as a taste. You know, when we do the fourth step tomorrow, you're not expected to be able to do all of your inventory, but it will certainly be an introduction to that. We may or may not use the whiteboard when we do it. If people don't understand the process after it's explained and they're mystified, Chris and I are here all weekend to be peppered with questions, and there's a lot of other guys in the room have got significant experience with this as well. So, you know, we're not gurus, we're not anything, we're just members that have done this once or twice or three times before. So, I titled tonight in my little cheat sheet here as the setup. And I think steps 1, 2, 3 is the setup. It's the setup, you know, me in a position that tomorrow I might start to look at some action steps. So, if I'm to think about step one, where I thought we might go first up, is that we'll go to how it works to the three pertinent ideas. And I want to start there. And I just want to start with A of the three pertinent ideas. It goes like this. That we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. Step one is we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable, and that A of the three pertinent ideas pertains to step one. It says that I'm alcoholic and I cannot manage my own life. It doesn't say that's when I'm drunk. It's saying that I am an alcoholic and I cannot manage my own life. From there, I wanted to very quickly just jump to We Agnostics on page 44. And this is probably how the weekend's going to look. It's going to be jumping around all over the joint. You're going to be thinking, why is he going there? Why is he doing this? Why is he doing that? But trust me, I just want to try and jump around to a few things. I just want to have a look at the first paragraph in We Agnostics on page 44. There's two questions. It says, if, when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, then you're probably alcoholic. If that be the case, you are suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. So two questions are asked of me. The first step, if you like, is covered from the front of the book through the doctor's opinion all the way to chapter 4, We Agnostics, and he nails me with two questions. And the two questions are, if when I honestly want to, I find I cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking I have little control over the amount I take. And he says, if that's the case, I'm probably alcoholic. And I need to find this spiritual awakening. To try and validate those two questions, or to lay substance to those two questions, and to probably bring out that diagram behind me on the wall, which is the cycle of alcoholism, I'll now go backwards to the doctor's opinion, if we can, and start on. It's going to be different for every book, so Chris, help me out here. Where are we going to go? In different books, it's going to be different places. I want to go to the second letter that Dr. Silkworth wrote. He wrote the first letter. There was a brief summary of that first letter by Bill. The second letter starts, the subject presented in this book seems to be of paramount importance. I want to go over that page to the next page. And to the top of the page where it starts off, we believe. Are we in the right spot? People know where we are. Chris, do you want to...
Yep, sure. Yep, everyone got it? It's going to be different because they... It's going to be different in different books. So it goes like this. We believe... And so I suggested a few years ago that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. That the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve.
Okay, look, I think that in most people in the room, we're talking to people who sing the choir, who are part of, who understand this language. But for those who don't understand the language, this paragraph is probably one of the most important paragraphs in the textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous, because it explains to me why it is that I can't drink normally, why it is that I don't have the ability to have an off switch once I start. And he says that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics, so this is what happens when I drink it, when I take a drink of alcohol. When I pick up a drink of alcohol, I set off this thing called an allergic reaction. And this allergic reaction manifests itself or indicates itself as this thing called a phenomenon of craving. They're all fancy words that I didn't quite understand, but all it means is that once I start drinking, I used to get that taste. It was like the invisible chain came out from the bar and it got me around my leg, and if I only set out to have one or two, I changed my mind after I started. Mm. It's an allergic reaction because 9 out of 10 people who drink alcohol don't have that reaction that 1 out of 10 seems to, and it's an allergic reaction based on the definition of an allergy is an abnormal reaction to a food, beverage or a substance. And I see that it's an abnormal reaction based on what the majority of the population does. 9 out of 10 people seem to drink successfully. They don't have that reaction. I have that reaction. It's abnormal based on what the majority of the population does. This craving, this thing, a phenomenon, they don't understand why it happens, but it does. This craving is something that it doesn't happen in the average temperate drinker. He says it never occurs in the average temperate drinker. Now, never's not once. He says that once that I have this allergic reaction to alcohol, there's no way of going back to normal social drinking. This determines and validates why it was, and when I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, that they said that one drink's too many and 100's not enough, and it was the first drink that did the damage. And I knew from my practical experience that I didn't know why, but I knew that when I started drinking, I lost control. You know, Bill Wilson's summary between the two letters, he said in this statement that follows, this letter that we're now reading, it will explain many things for which I could not otherwise account. It absolutely made perfect sense to me when I read it, and it explained to me why it was that I react the way that I do when I drink. When I drink, I don't have an off switch. And when I drink, and it becomes, this becomes the single most identifying factor of what it is to be an alcoholic. If I want to try and work with another alcoholic or try to disarm another alcoholic with the truth, I will talk to that person that I'm trying to help, not about what I do as a drinker, not about the activities or the incidents or the trouble or the places, people and things that I affect when I drink, but what happens to me bodily and mentally when I pick up a drink. That when I pick up a drink, I just seem to have an overwhelming sensation for more of the same. And I have another, and I have another, and all of a sudden I don't have an off switch. And that person is probably going to identify with that more than they are if I'm going to tell them about the incidents that I do as a drunken man. Dr. Silkworth talks a lot about this allergic reaction. He talks more about this than he does about anything else. But if we jump from that paragraph and I jump down to the bottom paragraph, we'll read from Men and Women Drink. If you would take from there, Chris.
Yep. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the truth from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable and discontent unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. After they succumb to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of the spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless that person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery.
Okay, so this talks about what I'm like before I pick up a drink. He says that I drink essentially because I like the effect produced by alcohol. I could tell you I like this drink more than that drink. I found drinks that were more palatable for me. But if I was to be completely honest, the reasons that I drank was I drank alcohol because I loved that sensation that the drinking produced, that sense of ease and comfort which come from drinking. I loved the effect produced by alcohol. He says that sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, while I admit that it is wrong, at certain times I cannot differentiate the true from the false. If I cannot differentiate the true from the false, then I can't see right from wrong. If I cannot differentiate the true from the false, that's probably, if you like, one of the first statements in the book that's going to start to help me as a reader, as a person who's trying to learn something about this subject matter, that it's one of the first statements that's going to indicate what insanity looks like with respect to alcoholism. Insanity is not what I do as a drunken person, but insanity is the thought process which precedes a relapse into drinking. And when I'm restless, irritable and discontent, when I'm sober, I have a mind that at certain times just doesn't see right from wrong. I can't differentiate the true from the false. Restless, irritable and discontent are three words that you could spend, I could spend 5 hours talking about what restless, irritable and discontent means. But that describes what my untreated alcoholism, that describes what my abstinence looks like. My abstinence is uncomfortable. People don't treat me well. Things don't go my way. She's not talking to me. This situation should have went the other way. I'm under pressure with my boss. The guy in the road cuts me off in the traffic. I'm restless. I'm uncomfortable. I want to be somewhere else. I'm discontent. Doesn't matter where I am, I want to be somewhere else. That describes my problem when I'm sober. And when I'm restless, irritable and discontent, my brain starts to look for a solution. It starts to look for something that worked in the past to remove those feelings. And what worked in the past when I was a 15-year-old kid and the hook was set was when I picked up a drink at 15, I found something that solved that problem. I found something that made me feel significantly better than I felt when I was sober. And alcohol gave me a sense of ease and comfort which I knew through no other way but by drinking, and it enabled me to join the group. It enabled me to come and party. It enabled me to come and play. It made me feel the way that you look without alcohol in your system. It took me from the outside of life looking in, and it took me and dropped me right in the middle of life, and I loved it. So when I'm restless, irritable and discontented, my mind starts to think, well, what can solve that? And I go back to that old tested and tried proven formula for removing those feelings, and it's called drinking, the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once from drinking. And it's drinking that I might be in that situation. I might be watching other people who are drinking with impunity. They're drinking around me with impunity, and I'm thinking, well, why not me? You know, maybe this time it's going to be different. Maybe this time I won't drink with that person. I'll change my brand. I'll do something before I drink which might make it more easy for me to control and enjoy my drink. Whatever the lie is, my brain tells me that lie. I have that alcoholic insanity where I can't differentiate the truth from false. I pick up a drink. All of a sudden I've set off that allergic reaction again. One drink's too many and 100's not enough, and I go through the well-known stages of a spree. And when I go through the well-known stages of a spree, I'm a blackout drinker and I emerge remorseful, because let me tell you, when I'm drinking, nobody is going to come up to me tomorrow and tell me how good I was. Nobody has ever come up to me and told me how helpful I was. When I wake up the next day, people want to fill in gaps that I don't want to hear about. And I tell you what, I've got an alcoholic national anthem that I sang again and again and again, and that is that I'm sorry and I promise this is never going to happen again. And I sang that again, and I've got a firm resolution that I'm not going to do it again. Now, he says this is done over and over, and unless I experience an entire psychic change, there's zero hope that I'm going to stay sober. Now, those two paragraphs develop that alcoholic cycle that's on the wall behind it. It's in your handout. There's two parts of that cycle. The right-hand side of that diagram describes that first paragraph. That's the physical. The left-hand side of the diagram describes what my life is like when I am sober, when I'm restless, irritable and discontent, and I get to a point that I have this mental obsession, this thought that overrules all thoughts. It's like you wave your hand in front of my eyes and I blink. It's a learned response. I cannot stop that from happening. Now, the 12 steps, it talks about it in the 12 and 12. It's in the 12 steps and 12 traditions in the preface that says that the 12 steps are a group of principles spiritual in nature, when if practiced as a way of life, will expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. He says that unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope for his recovery. Unless I can have an entire psychic change, I'm sooner or later going to drink. If I relate to the cycle, which I do, and I'm not doing anything about trying to find an effective mental defence against picking up the first drink, it's just a clock. It's just sitting there ticking. Sooner or later, it's going to get to a point where I'm going to be blinded with that with the fact that I can't see right from wrong. The cycle is the most disarming piece of information that I've got that helps me to identify, but furthermore helps me to help others by explaining that predicament. If I jump now from there, I want to go to page 34 in More About Alcoholism. I want to talk just very quickly about, I'll find it. I'm going to start at the bottom of page 34. More About Alcoholism is a chapter that's entirely devoted to enabling me to identify the mental states which precedes a relapse into drinking. There's going to be four stories, four case studies in More About Alcoholism. There's going to be the man of 30. There's going to be Jim. There's going to be the jaywalker. And there's going to be Fred. I'm only going to look at Jim. Jim was a guy by the name of Ralph Furlong, got sober in 1938, and his original story was another prodigal story. Anybody who's interested in history, and over the course of the weekend, there's a folder up here that's rich of history of the early beginnings of Alcoholics Anonymous, feel free to come up and have a look. In your handout that you've got over the page from the cycle, there's a little bit of a summary page on More About Alcoholism. And it breaks down the four case studies into the example of the man of 30, Jim the car salesman, the jaywalker, and Fred the accountant. It talks about the lie, what happened, the actions that were caused, and the outcome. And I need to remember that whole chapter was entirely there to show me that my main problem centres in my mind rather than in my body, because no matter how anybody's memory in this room remembers the last time that they drank, but let me tell you the last time that I drank. Right before I picked up a drink, I was sober. I didn't have a drinking problem, I had a thinking problem. And More About Alcoholism is for exactly that reason. It's to describe the mental states which precedes a relapse into drinking, he says, because that is the crux of the problem. So I might ask Chris if he can from how then shall we? And we'll read through Jim.
How then shall we help our readers determine to their own satisfaction whether they are one of us? The experiment of quitting for a period of time will be helpful, but we think we can render an even greater service to the alcoholic sufferers and perhaps to the medical fraternity. So we shall describe some of the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking, for obviously this is the crux of the problem.
So the crux of the problem is a decisive, important point at issue. The crux of the problem. Okay, Chris.
What sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? Friends who have reasoned with him after a spree which has brought him to the point of divorce or bankruptcy are mystified when he walks directly into a saloon. Why does he? What is he thinking? Our first example is a friend we should call Jim. This man has a charming wife and family. He inherited a lucrative automobile agency. He has a commendable World War record. He's a good salesman. Everybody likes him. He's an intelligent man, normal so far as we can see, except for a nervous disposition. He did no drinking until he was 35. In a few years, he becomes so violent when intoxicated, he had to be committed. On leaving the asylum, he came into contact with us. We told him what we knew of alcoholism and the answer we have found. He made a beginning. His family was reassembled and he began to work as a salesman for a business he lost through drinking. All went well for a time, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. To his consternation, he found himself drunk half a dozen times in rapid succession. On each of these occasions, we worked with him, reviewing carefully what had happened. He agreed he was a real alcoholic in serious condition. He knew he faced another trip to the asylum if he kept on. Moreover, he would lose his family for whom he had a deep affection. Yet he got drunk again. We asked him to tell us exactly how it happened. This is his story. I came to work on Tuesday morning. I remember I felt irritated that I had to be a salesman for a concern I once owned. I had a few words with the boss, but nothing serious. Then I decided to drive into the country and see one of my prospects for a car. On the way I felt hungry, so I stopped at a roadside place where they have a bar. I had no intention of drinking. I just thought I would get a sandwich. I had the notion that I might find a customer for a car at this place, which was familiar, for I'd been going to it for years. I'd eaten there many times during the month I was sober. I sat down at a table and ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk. Still no thought of drinking. I ordered another sandwich and decided to have another glass of milk. Suddenly, the thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach. I ordered a whiskey and poured it into the milk. I vaguely sensed I was not being any too smart, but I felt reassured as I was taking whiskey on a full stomach. The experiment went so well that I ordered another whiskey and poured it into more milk. That didn't seem to bother me, so I tried another. Thus started one more journey to the asylum for Jim. Here was the threat of commitment, the loss of family and position, to say nothing of the intense mental and physical suffering which drinking always caused him. He had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic, yet all reasons for not drinking were easily pushed aside in favour of the foolish idea that he could take whiskey if only mixed it with milk. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. How can such a lack of the proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else?
All right, thanks. So, Jim, first example. So, I get to have a look at Jim. Seems like a decent kind of guy. Everybody likes him. He's got this bit of a nervous disposition. End up being committed. Came into contact with the members of Alcoholics Anonymous of the day. What did they do? We told him what we knew of alcoholism. So they would have laid out the information of the day. They would have laid out what it was to be an alcoholic. They would have talked about the hopeless condition of mind and body that it is to be an alcoholic. And the answer, they would have outlined what the answer, and the answer is this spiritual answer, this entire psychic change that Dr. Silkworth spoke about. He said he made a beginning. If I was to make a beginning, step three might even look like a beginning. It's like a starting point. It's getting me on the starting blocks to actually start to do something. Things seem to go all right for him. But he failed to enlarge his spiritual life and to enlarge upon the decision that I'm asked to do in the third step is to do the rest of the program. To enlarge my spiritual life is what Bill would talk about in his personal stories through work and self-sacrifice for others. To fail to enlarge upon my spiritual life would be to fail to embark upon the program of action from four through to the end of the program. And so what happened? He got drunk half a dozen times in rapid succession. So these guys, they went back and they worked with again and again and again and again. They were good AAs. They were doing, you know, life-saving and life-changing work with this guy, trying to give him spiritual first aid. And they worked with him, and he kept getting drunk. And he knew that he was an alcoholic, and he knew that drinking was going to cause one more, you know, a journey back to the asylum. This was not anything that he didn't know. So they went through it and they said, well, listen, you know, let's have a think about it. Tell us exactly what happened. He said, well, this is my story. He said, I went to work, a bit irritated, had to be working for a salesman for a company that he owned. Yeah, well, I guess what I'm looking for here is I go through this, I'm looking for what's normal thinking and what's not normal thinking. I'd be irritated too if I had to go back and work for a business that I once owned. Had a few words with the boss, no big deal. He's off to drive to the country. He's going out probably to see a farmer, probably try to sell a car to a farmer, and on the way there he stops at a roadside place where they have a bar. No big deal. He's done it many times in the times he had not been drinking. He even thought that he might have had the notion, he might even find somebody to sell a car to there. He's a salesman. He's on point duty here. He's thinking, you know, I've got the opportunity. I might make some money. I might sell another car while I'm here. Sits down, orders a sandwich, glass of milk, normal thinking. Orders another sandwich, another glass of milk, and then it goes to italics. And Joe and Charlie said, italics is important, squiggly writing. We need to read it twice. And this is where his thinking changes. He says, suddenly the thought crossed his mind, if he was to put an ounce of whiskey, it wouldn't hurt him on a full stomach. Ordered another one, poured it into more milk. You know, all of a sudden you can start to see him say to the barman, what the hell are you doing putting milk in with my whiskey, you know? And he just, and one more journey to the asylum for Jim. You know, he had much knowledge of himself as an alcoholic. See, self-knowledge avails me nothing. You know, I've known people that knew this information better than I knew it. They articulated it better when they were sober, but they knew this information. Information doesn't keep me sober. Self-knowledge doesn't keep me sober. You know, understanding this information just gives me the ability next time I'm drunk and I'm standing at the bar, I can tell the guy beside me exactly what's going on. Man, I've got that allergic reaction. Can't you see it? Look, that's why I'm drunk here. You know, I am is a knowledgeable drunken fool standing at the bar. Self-knowledge avails me nothing. It didn't help him either. All reasons for not drinking were easily pushed. This foolish idea that it would be okay if you drank whiskey with milk. And where I'm trying to get to with this is, whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. So I've already given one definition of insanity, that at certain times I cannot differentiate the true from the false. We took that from the doctor's opinion. That's insanity. And he said, whatever the word may be, we call this plain insanity. Here's another definition. How can such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? A lack of proportion of the ability to think straight. And we can find lots of definitions as we go through the book. But that case study shows me that the problem is not drinking, the problem is in thinking. The crux of my problem is the thought process which precedes a relapse into drinking. And Jim's story tried to highlight that. I'm going to jump back. I want to go to about page 24. I'm going to ask Chris to read one paragraph and then I might try and get out of step one.
Just before you do, but I'll just make a couple of quick comments. The doctor's opinion doesn't have any good, any happy information, does it? It's telling most chronic alcoholics are doomed, you're in trouble. There's no, we don't see a way out of this. And it's designed to do that. It's meant to do that. Step one's not to be a happy place. Like, oh yeah, I've got step one, great. It's meant to be, you know, how great does it sound that I'm going to drink no matter what? And I can't stop myself from drinking. Once I start, I'm going to go. And there's no possible way I can stop myself doing that. And so, you know, anyone that says, oh, I've done step one, I'm feeling pretty happy about it, I'd question whether you've really done step one, because step one is an inside job. It's probably the most important step. And I just wanted to say about the doctor, Pete said it, that he really hones in on that physical factor, and he says that it never occurs in the average centre drinker. And that's really important information for you guys. It's important information if you're working with someone. Because if you don't have that allergic reaction, you don't need to be here. You don't need to be here. And the doctor emphasises it, and he says any picture which leaves out that physical factor is incomplete. And never, not once. And, you know, I looked at that and thought, well, do I know somebody like that? And I look at my wife, and it doesn't happen to my wife. She's one of those ones that can drink a glass of wine and leave it there, you know. She abuses alcohol, in my opinion, but she'll drink half a glass and then leave it there. And I'm looking at her going, what? You know, because she doesn't have that allergic reaction. And, you know, it was said to me, you know, I don't think I ever once said to the barman after two drinks, when he said, do you want another one, Chris, I didn't say anything, go, you know what, I've had sufficient tonight, I think I'll go home. It never happened. And so that's an important part for the doctor's opinion that he hones right in on that. So if you're wondering whether, and Pete said it, we get some clues. That's one of the clues. If you don't have that vision, you're incomplete, and then it just, you know, 44 pages plus the doctor's opinion narrows it down to two questions. That's it. Alcoholics, we complicate simple things. We've got a pamphlet there that's 44 questions on whether you're an alcoholic or not. No, there's just two really. If you go to that, you know, we're agnostics, it just breaks it down to those two questions. And so, yeah, I'll just add that, please. Sorry.
We were leading a book study one time. He knows where I'm going with this. We were leading a book study one time. We went through the doctor's opinion, talked about the allergic reaction to alcohol. Never ever occurs in the average temperate drinker. And there was a person sitting at that book study that person then stood up and said, well, I don't have that allergic reaction. Bear in mind, this person had been in Alcoholics Anonymous as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous for over 25 years at that time. And that person said, I don't have that allergic reaction to alcohol. I said, what are you doing here? Why would you be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous if you don't have that allergic reaction to alcohol? And that person told me that they came in under the third tradition, and the third tradition states the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. I said, that's the shortened version of the third tradition that Earl Treat, a guy who was sponsored by Dr. Bob, shortened the traditions to get them onto a banner. I said, but the third tradition in the long form states, our membership should include all those who suffer from alcoholism. Now, alcoholism is described exactly what Chris just talked about. Alcoholism is described as a person who is bodily and different to his fellows. A person like me who has an abnormal reaction that never, that's not once, that never occurs in the average temperate drinker. Why would you want to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? It didn't end well.
There's another statement there that says that, you know, we can't safely use alcohol in any form at all.
Doesn't matter how it gets in.
That's a warning sign, because I've seen lots of people eat it in food, and I've seen lots of people drinking kombucha or whatever they want to book. Oh, it doesn't matter, it's only got 1% in it. If you want to play Russian roulette, that's what you've got to ask yourself. In any form at all. Just quickly again, because we've got lots to get through. Notice in Jim's story where the insane idea comes suddenly, just came like that. And he said, I vaguely sense that what I was doing was probably not a good idea, but the thought came suddenly. I've asked people, been around for a fair chunk of time, I ask people to fast. I go up and ask them. So I'm curious, especially people who've been around for a long time. I said, do you ever think you were going to drink again? And all of them say, no, never thought I'd ever drink again, because that mental obsession comes suddenly. So again, it's about, step one's not a happy place. I'm sitting here thinking, oh yeah, no worries, I've been around for a long time, I'm sober for a long time. That doesn't guarantee you're going to stay sober. If I get caught up in untreated alcoholism, I can be just as, like, you know, old mate here, so. Sorry, please.
I want to just do one more little thing on step one and then we'll look at step two. But the 12 and 12 says that step one is the only step I need to do 100%. All the rest are guides to progress. They're things that I aim for. But the only step I need to do 100%. Every problem that I have in Alcoholics Anonymous, any problem I'm having with any step, goes back to a step one problem. If I understand step one, I'll do whatever I'm asked to do. In the book he uses language, and I love the language he uses, language like rocketed, catapulted, launched. And all of those start from a platform of surrender. All of those start from a platform of bedrock. And that platform of bedrock is the first step. The first step is the thing that I need to fully concede to my innermost self, that is the absolute core truth of my life. Because if I do accept that, then I'm not going to debate some of the later steps that I'm asked to do some of the work in. One last thing we'll read, and then we'll just jump into a little bit on step two. Page 24, and Chris, if you read the italics, fact.
The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We're unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago, where we're without defence against the first drink.
The fact is the important point at issue. I've lost the power of choice. I don't have the ability to choose whether I can drink or not. I have a problem when I'm drinking it, and I have a problem when I'm not drinking it. I'm powerless over alcohol because I can't control the amount I take once I start, and I'm powerless over alcohol because at certain times I have no effective mental defence against that first drink. And page 43, just to get out of this section, is right in the middle of your diagram, it's right in the middle of that cycle there. It says the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defence against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide that such a defence, that his defence must come from a higher power. So that segues me into step two. Step two is that came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I'm just going to jump back to the three pertinent ideas again, if we will. and how it works. And page 60. B of the three pertinent ideas is that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, and C, that God could and would if he were sought. So part A of the three pertinent ideas is step one, and part B and C of the three pertinent ideas is step two. Step one represents the problem, step two represents the solution to that problem. Now where I'm going to go to try and look at that is that we'll go to page 25 in There Is a Solution and Chris from There Is a Solution.
Yep, that part
bottom of the page.
Yep. There is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the levelling of our pride, the confessions of shortcoming, which the process requires for a successful confirmation. But we saw that it really worked in others, and we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we've been living it. When therefore we were approached by those of whom the problem has been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We've found much of heaven and been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence, for which we've never, ever, not even dreamed. The great fact is just this, and nothing less, that we've had deep and effective spiritual experiences, which has revolutionised our whole attitude towards life, towards our fellows, and towards God's universe. The central fact of our life today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. If you are a serious alcoholic, as we believe there is no middle-of-the-road solution. We're in a position where life is becoming impossible and we have passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid. We have but two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could, and the other, to accept spiritual help.
All right, good. So there is a solution. And the solution looks like the following. It's going to be a bit of self-searching. There's going to be some levelling of my pride, confession of shortcomings. So what the solution is suggesting is that the further steps that I'm asked to take are going to be levelling of my pride. There's going to be some self-searching in step four, but for the successful consummation of bringing about this solution. But when I get to see that it works in others, when I get to see the examples of other people, you see, Alcoholics Anonymous is an evidence-based program. It's a program of attraction rather than promotion. It's a results-orientated program. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and what I do is I get to sit there and listen to other people share their experience as a drinker. They get to tell me what it was like as a drinker, what happened as a consequence of taking the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and what their life's like today as a consequence of the change that has been brought over them by the Alcoholics Anonymous 12-step program. That's what happens in a good structured meeting, is that people lay out a simple kit of spiritual tools. People in Alcoholics Anonymous speakers lay out that simple kit of spiritual tools for my inspection. I get to make a decision what I'm going to do with that. And if it's attractive, I'm going to go for it. I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous almost 33 years now, and I tell you, if there was something that was more attractive than doing this, I'd be doing it, but it's not. Alcoholics Anonymous is still attractive to me because what I see here is better than what I came in with. It is an attractive program that inspires me to follow in other people's footsteps. So when I've seen other people recover from the same seemingly hopeless state of mind and of body that I have and have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence, they've been taken into a spiritual way of life that was better than the life they led before, and I know that through their stories, and I know that through their example, I'll go along with it. I'll go along with it because the same as that happened to Bill when he was confronted with Ebby, that he had to be interested because he was hopeless. I was hopeless when I got here, and I was interested to find out what it is that I needed to do. He says the great fact, the great important point at issue is that we have found this and nothing less, that they've had deep and effective spiritual experiences. These deep and effective spiritual experiences got an asterisk beside it, but he describes and says what it's about. This deep and effective spiritual experience will revolutionise my whole attitude toward life, toward my fellows, and towards God's universe. And he says the central fact is that my life today is the absolute certainty of this living creator within me has entered into my heart and lives in a way that is indeed miraculous. So he says, if I am seriously alcoholic, there's no middle of the road solution. And we could talk and think about, well, what does a middle of the road solution look like? Think about trying to cross the road and standing in the middle. You know, I'm not anywhere. I need to move to a very, very different place. And he said that my life was becoming impossible, and I passed through it into a region where there was no return through human aid. See, step one tells me there's no return through human aid. No human power is going to solve that problem. No person is going to be able to help me with that problem that God can and would if he was thought. And he said, I get to a position where I'm given two alternatives. And this is the first of five times through the book up to step three that it gives me two alternatives. Alternative one, he says, one was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of the intolerable situation as best as we could. Step one, stay drunk, don't do anything. Or the other was to accept spiritual help. So he's starting to try and get me into thinking, well, what do I want? Do I want to be doomed to an alcoholic death, or do I want to live on a spiritual basis? Do I want step one, or do I want step two? Do I want to try and find a solution to the problem? And so he's sort of starting to work on me to get me to get to a point that in step three I'm asked to make a decision to choose which way I'm going to go. There was an asterisk there. The asterisk takes us to the back of the book. It takes us to an appendix in the back of the book that wasn't in the first printing. Three times I'm asked to go to the back of the book and read this appendices. The author obviously believed it was an important piece of information because there's no other piece of information in the book that he says, I better read this because it's really important. So maybe if we jump the page wherever it's going to be, the appendices, because for different books it'll be different places. It was 569 in a book I once had, but it might be somewhere different in the book you guys are holding. It's Appendix 2, Spiritual Experience. 544?
567 in the fourth edition. It's all right here.
It'll be everywhere. Want to snack it up?
Yep. The terms spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading shows the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested among us in many different forms. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experience must be in the nature of a sudden and spectacular upheaval. Happy for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Though it was not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover they must acquire an immediate overwhelming God consciousness, followed once by a vast change in the feeling and outlook. Among our rapid growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the differences long before he is himself. He finally realises he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, and such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource which they presently identify with their own conception of the power greater than themselves. Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have any difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation of evidence.
Okay, so as I mentioned, this is an appendix that was added to the back of the book to give more information after the first printing, because the first printing gave readers the impression that what happened to Bill and some of the other personal stories, that the conversionary experience had to be the same as what the co-founder and other people had mentioned. That very, very rapid, fast, evangelical, religious experience that changed that person in a heartbeat. And people who read it thought that, you know, geez, that's not going to happen to me. You know, I used to liken it to what happened to John Belushi in the Blues Brothers, when he said, you know, the light comes through the roof, and you know, and he goes down the aisle to James Brown doing handstands, and I'm thinking, well, that's maybe what a religious experience looks like. But in an effort to try and dispel the perception that this personality change had to be fast and sudden and spectacular, he put the appendix in the book. So he said the terms spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times. Now, the 12th step used to say, having had a spiritual experience, and it was one of the few things that they changed, and they changed it to spiritual awakening. A spiritual experience and spiritual awakening both do exactly the same thing. They both bring about a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. That's the solution, right there. A personality, I need to undergo a personality change sufficient to recover from alcoholism. To have an entire psychic change that the doctor talked about in the doctor's opinion. To practice a group of principles which will expel the obsession to drink alcohol and enable me to become happily and usefully whole, that he talked about in the 12 steps and 12 traditions. Now, whether it happens fast or whether it happens slow, as long as it happens, it doesn't matter. Joe and Charlie used to do an analogy where they would say, listen, if you're doing your washing and you're putting the whites in the washing machine, and you put the bleach in, does the whites go white when you close the lid or when the washing machine's finished? It really didn't matter. The whites go white. Whether it happened straight away or whether it took time for the machine to go through the process. Whether I have this thing happen fast or slow, it doesn't matter. But the results are going to be the same. It's been my experience that the people that have fast conversionary experiences, they kind of think they got it and they don't need to continue doing it. The ones that have spiritual awakenings, which is the educational variety that the Harvard psychologist James talked about in the book Varieties of Religious Experience, they're the people that he talks about in A Vision for You, that trudge and walk with purpose and sometimes with heavy laden feet, but little bit by little bit through taking action slowly but surely over a period of change, time they change. He says that the change that happens to them, they've got no clue that it's even happening. That the people around people who are changing like that, was certainly true in my case, that I wasn't aware of it, but the people who were around me were aware that the change was happening. It's that educational variety. Slowly, slowly over a period of time. You know, Clancy used to always say it, that Alcoholics Anonymous will do slowly what alcohol used to do quickly. That little bit by little bit through taking those actions, I'll slowly but surely get to feel enough. And that personality change, doesn't matter how it happens, whether it happens fast or slow, that's the solution to alcoholism. And that's what the 12 steps are about, is to bring about that personality change. It talks about that it's going to be a profound alteration in my reaction to life. He says, with few exceptions, our members find they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource. which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. I'm not confused. I was for a long time. I'm not confused today to where I need to go to look to try and find God. God, I don't need to go to a church. That might be helpful for some people, but God is within. God is a part of my makeup. The 12 steps, and we titled this weekend, Uncover, Discover and Discard. It's not ours, it's not mine, it's something that was borrowed, stolen, plagiarised from an old sober member a long time ago. But that's exactly what the 12 steps are about. The 12 steps are to uncover, discover and discard the stuff that's within me that blocks me from this untapped inner resource, which he says that we presently identify with our own conception of power greater than ourselves. I'm not going to read it, but it's in We Agnostic. He says, deep down in every man, woman and child is that fundamental idea of God. He said it may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in the final analysis it's only there that he may be found. God's within me. I don't have to find anything, I just need to get rid of a lot of stuff that's blocking me. And the 12 steps are a process of uncovering, discovering and removing those blockages. The things that are going to stop me from enabling me to go through that process is that he says that anyone, any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems can recover, provided I don't have a closed mind towards spiritual concepts. In the chapter We Agnostics, he uses a word seven times. That's seven times he uses a word called prejudice. Preconceived ideas that I have no experience on. You know, ideas, you know, an opinion that's based on no evidence or facts or personal experience. It's the last part of what he just read there, wrote there with contempt prior to investigation. The only thing that I can be defeated by is if I have an attitude of intolerance towards spiritual principles or belligerent denial. He says that no one, not me, not anybody else, needs to have a problem, providing I've got these essentials. And the essentials to recovery are the three things that he's going to outline. And quite often people say it's a how program. How? It's honesty, it's open-mindedness and willingness. It's not a how program, it's a who program. I think the who is that I need to find God. The who is that I need to re-engage with something that I was born with, because I was born with it. But the who is willingness, honesty and open-mindedness. Three times he sends me back to this chapter to try and get my head around that. Everything in Alcoholics Anonymous that I do is preceded by willingness first. I become willing, then I sooner or later become honest. And I then slowly but surely become open-minded. It doesn't happen in any other format. If I've got willingness, honesty and open-mindedness, I can recover. If I am not closed by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial towards spiritual principles. He thought that was relatively important. Important enough that he sends me three times, twice in this chapter and once in We Agnostics, to come back and read it. It must be important. It defines what it is the solution to alcoholism, that personality change sufficient to bring about recovery.
So, I guess based on the flamethrower on me butt from step one, you know, I'm going to be more willing to lean towards the door of accepting spiritual help, and only the flamethrower at me butt with regards to my step one experience is going to push me through that door, because unfortunately, you know, I need to be in a lot of pain. And it talks about there the levelling of our pride, and I think for me, and this is only my experience, is that step one is the start of the crack in that ego, because the ego needs to collapse, and the way that the crack starts is step one, and it's going to ask me to do other stuff so it completely collapses, but ultimately it's from step one, and step two is, yeah, it's based on that information. I stand at that doorway. Our sponsor puts it perfect. Door number one. Jails, institutions or death, or keep living the way you're living, or door number two, accept spiritual help. There's no door number three. There's only those two doors. And unfortunately, most of us stand there and go, which door will I go in? It's crazy, isn't it, really? based on our step one experience. And I think one of the, you know, where agnostics talks about preconceived values, prejudice, the whole chapter's on my preconceived values, and it says, do not let these deter you from asking yourself what these things mean to you. Not what they mean to me or Peter or anyone else, what do they mean to you? And when I understood that, it opened up for me, because I didn't have to accept what you guys were telling me about the higher power of God. It was what it meant for me, and it helped me to walk through that door. So, yeah.
Beautiful. All right. Page 45. We're agnostics. I'll read this little bit and go through it quickly. I'm going to start off first paragraph down. Lack of power, that was our dilemma. So it's taken 44 pages plus the doctor's opinion, information in the forwards and the preface, if you like, for him to get it down to three words, what my problem is. Three words. Lack of power. That's my problem. I don't have the power. I do not have the power. He says, lack of power, that was our dilemma. Now in eight short sentences, it's going to define the whole book, and I'll go through them. First one was lack of power. The second one was that is my dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how were we to find this power? Well, that's exactly, not kind of, not sort of, not in a rough way, not in a roundabout way. He says, well, that is exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself which will solve your problem. What's my problem is that I have lack of power. What's my problem is that I've got this obsession. Lack of power is that I have an insane thought. Lack of power is that I have the lack of proportion of the ability to think straight when it comes to alcohol. Lack of power is that I cannot differentiate the true from the false when it comes to alcohol. That this power greater than myself will solve that problem. He says that means we have written a book which we believe to be spiritual as well as moral. And of course, there is going to be talk about God. So lack of power, that's my dilemma. Had to find the power. How and why, that's exactly what the book's about, to enable me to find that power. Eight short questions defines my problem and what the book is going to deliver for me, is to show me how and where to find that power. I want to get out of this chapter by reading one more piece out of We Agnostics 46 to 47. I'll ask Chris if he could read from Much to Our Relief. And we'll go across the page, Chris, to Spiritual Structure Can Be Built.
Yep. Much to our relief, we discover we did not need to consider another's conception of God. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and to effect contact with him. As soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe, underlying the totality of things, we began to be possessed with a new sense of power and direction, provided we took other simple steps. We found that God does not make too hard a turn to those who seek him. To us, the realm of the spirit is a broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidden. To those who earnestly seek it, it is open, we believe, to all men. When therefore we speak to you of God, we mean your own conception of God. This applies too to other spiritual expressions which you find in this book. Do not let any prejudice you may have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you. At the start, this was all we needed to commit spiritual growth, to effect our first conscious relation with God as we understood him. Afterward, we found ourselves accepting many things which then seemed entirely out of reach. That was growth, but if we used to grow, we had to begin somewhere. So we used our own conception, however limited it was. We need to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? As soon as a man can say that he does believe or is willing to believe, we emphatically assure him he is on his way. It has been repeated provingly among us that upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderful, effective spiritual structure can be built.
Okay, so again, he sent me back there. I've only just read a couple of pages. Hang on, you've probably already forgotten. I think you should go back there again. Reread Appendix 2. It's the second time. So I don't need to consider another's conception of God, whatever my own conception, however inadequate that may be. And he starts to give me, you know, as soon as I've admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, you know, if I think about what Ebi did for Bill when Ebi melted the icy intellectual mountain whose shadow Bill had shivered many years, when he said to Bill, why don't you choose your own conception? And Bill said it just absolutely melted that. It just took it away, you know. It didn't have to be the God of the preachers or the God of the spheres or whatever it was. Bill was able to choose his own conception. And throughout the book, I guess, Bill gives many different alternatives. Well, here you go, why don't you try this? Or why don't you try that? So here's some of them. He says, creative intelligence, spirit of the universe, realm of the spirit. And I made a point one day of just jotting down things that he used as a metaphor, as a, well, you don't like the word God? Why don't you try some of these? He said, living creator. He said, power of good, power greater than ourselves. Creative intelligence, universal mind, spirit of nature. He used the word God, supreme being, spirit of the universe, realm of the spirit, great reality, director, father, principal, father of light, creator, all-powerful guiding maker, employer, czar of the heavens. He used a multitude of different things to try and get me across this coming to believe. Don't forget, the second step is very cleverly worded. He doesn't say come to know, come to fully understand, come to have faith in, come to totally define. He says I come. And I come to, like I start to wake up. And little bit by little bit I come to believe. And I come to believe because I am overwhelmed by the evidence. I'm overwhelmed by the simple kit of spiritual tools that is continually laid at my feet of people who I identify with as drinkers, and they tell me that their life was turned around as a consequence of believing in a power greater than themselves and taking certain simple actions. So he says, when therefore we speak of God, it means your own conception, whatever that might be. You know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I've said this many times. I went to a group, it was a Mitcham Young People's Group on a Tuesday night. It was a group I became a member of, and I got onto the group conscience there. They used to read How It Works. I said, you don't want to be doing that. I don't be reading that rubbish out. There's all that God in it. You're going to scare the newcomers away. I thought the stories were great until I'd start talking about that. I love the bashing and crashing, but as soon as I said, oh, God, what are you going to ruin a good story and you have to start talking about God? Well, there's power greater than yourself. Are you for real? I mean, I didn't like it. A few years down the track, that's the only reason that I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the only goal of Alcoholics Anonymous is to enable me to find this power, that when I find this power will solve my problem. My problem's not drinking, but my problem's the mental stage which precedes a relapse into that. So whatever my conception is, gathering of drunks, good orderly direction, the power of good that resides in alcoholics, the group of members that are sitting in this room have got more collective powers than me. Whatever's working for them, I'm happy to turn my life over to the care of that, because it's certainly better than the care of the idiot that had it before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, do not let any prejudice deter you. Prejudice, that's the third time he used it. The definition of that was old ideas deterring you from honestly asking yourself, what does it mean to me? Prejudice, preconceived ideas I've got no experience with. He says, I could start with my own conception, however limited that was. And I get to a point, he says, I just need to ask myself at one short question. This is a simple, short question. Do I now believe, Or am I even willing to believe that there's a power greater than myself? He says, as soon as I say I do, or I'm even willing to, he says, I'm emphatically assured I'm on my way. And a mate of mine said, listen, you don't even have to believe. You could just be suspicious there could be a power greater than yourself, and that's enough to make you beginning. And I've been suspicious all my life. I could buy that. I could buy, I'm non-suspicious. It might be something, you know what? I don't want to miss out here. I'll go along with it just to prove you guys wrong. Telling that group not to read how it works. Go figure. Again, he sends us back to the back of the book. So the object of step two is to come to believe. It's that process. Come to believe that this power greater than itself, whatever my definition of that is, can restore me to sanity, can bring about that personality change. Sanity is the ability to differentiate the true from false, not the inability to differentiate the true from false. If insanity is to believe a lie, then sanity has got to be able to see the truth. And why would I even be willing to believe? He didn't say that I had to honestly open-minded. He said willing, as long as I'm willing, just to ajar the door a little bit. He says he emphatically assures me that I'm on my way. Doesn't say come to know, doesn't say come to fully comprehend, doesn't say come to have faith in, come to totally define. It's that process of I come to, little bit by little bit I start to believe, and then I'm in a position where I'm open-minded and I can start to move forward. That's probably about as much as we wanted to look at for step two, and I'm going to get Chris to try and walk us through the third step, or the information for the third step. It's still the setup, because tomorrow morning we'll take the third step as a collective, and I'll lead that in the morning. We'll do that as a group. We'll do it on our knees. And we'll do it. We'll hold hands. We'll make it powerful and impactful. Anybody who comes to the Melbourne Men's Group, anybody who does a third step prayer, we grab a bunch of guys, half a dozen, a dozen, whatever. We go into a room and we go through a particular format, and we do that together as a collective. He and I did it with a group one time. There were 69 guys in a circle. It was really, really powerful. So we'll start tomorrow probably with the set aside prayer. Dean's going to take us through meditation. We'll do the 11th step St. Francis prayer to lead that in the morning. We'll do the set aside prayer to start the morning off tomorrow. We'll do a recap of the first three and do a collective third step prayer together and to kick it off. But where I wanted to go now and suggest that we start now to go through step three, and Chris will take us through step three, will be page 60. And we're probably just going to go back over those three pertinent ideas again as we walk through the information on page 60. Do you want me to read?
Yep. So I guess to set up for step three, and Pete's sort of walked us through that, is that, you know, that I start to get a bit more interested in, well, okay, if I'm screwed and there's no way now I can stop myself from drinking, no human power can do it. All right, all I've got to do is willing. Okay, I'm willing. You've got me willing, because I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired, so I'm willing. I'm willing to have a look at this. I don't believe, but you guys have got something here. There's something here, so I'm willing to believe that maybe this could work for me. And so, you know, the ABCs, it sets it up that, you know, I can't do this. Maybe something can. All right, what do I got to do now? What do you want me to do now? And it's going to ask me to make a decision. And hands up, who thinks the third step prayer is the decision? The third step prayer is the decision. That's what I thought for a long time too. But it's going to ask me to do some things before I say that third step prayer. And actually, the decision is before the third step prayer. And that was news to me. And I remember reading through this, you know, where it says, I'm being convinced we're at step three. And I was told, you know, the instruction manual for the steps are in the big book. And I read that and go, where's the freaking instructions for step one and two? There's no instructions for step one and two. It's just information. It's 44 pages plus the doctor's opinion, 50-odd pages. If you want to look at, you know, the working instructions to the steps are in the first 103 pages. So half the working part of the book is spent on step one. So I think that's how important it is, and I think Pete mentioned it's probably the most important step, because it's the one that's going to hurdle me through the rest of the steps if I'm convinced in here. People talk about step one experiences, and so there's no instructions, if you like, for step one and step two. It's just information so that I can self-diagnose and then make an informed decision on what I want to do. Keep doing what I'm doing, going to the bitter end, or do I want to accept spiritual help? So it's going to start to give me some instructions now. Now, I've read through this many, many times thinking, why are they trying to talk about this act and want to run the whole show? You know, I kind of get it, I don't understand. And I was lucky I had a sponsor that told me to make a couple of little notes in here and start to, instead of reading about some actor running a whole show, turn it into first person. Okay? Cross out the we and the me's and make it I and me. And it changed the whole game for me. I started to read, when they talk about read yourself into the book, I started to understand how I'm that actor. Every day of my life I wake up, I'm trying to arrange things. So we might go through that process, Pete, if that's cool. But just listen, so it says, being convinced we're at step three, which is that we decide to turn our will and our life over to God as we have a soul. Just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? Well, what do they mean by that? What am I turning over and what do I got to do? And it says the first requirement. So there's a requirement for step three. And that requirement is that I be convinced that my life run on self-will hasn't been successful. Now you would think that should be easy. Yeah, duh. I've been running my life and I've finished up in AA. But it's the ego is a funny thing. It does not like to relinquish control. And so, you know, it's not an easy... I didn't find it easy. I found it really hard to see, you know, even though I'd finished up in AA at 26, that me running the show hasn't worked. So we might read through it. So I'll read it through in first person and see how it turns the book onto me. So it says, being convinced that I was at step three, which is that I've decided to turn my will and my life over to God as the understood, just what do I have to do? What does that mean for me? What do I have to do? The first requirement is that I be convinced that my life run on self-will can hardly be successful. On that basis, I'm always in collision course with something or somebody, even though my motives are good. I try to live by self-propulsion. I'm like the actor who wants to run the whole show. I'm forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in my own way. If only my arrangements would stay put, if only people would do as I wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including me, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, I may be sometimes quite virtuous, I may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, I may be mean, egotistical, selfish, dishonest, but as with most humans, I'm more likely to have varied traits. See how it turns it in on me, and I start to look at that. And many times, you know, my sponsor says, when I'm having trouble out there in the big wide world, read page 60 to 63. Read it for a week and tell me how you're going. I'll read it, and I start to understand, you know, when I'm driving to work and someone cuts me off and I'm yelling out the window, get out of my way, you know, don't you understand, I'm more important to you. Or when I'm, you know, in the supermarket and I've got my trolley and I wheel it up to, I've got 12 items, I know I've got 12 items, so I've counted the 12 items and I go to the 12 items or more and there's someone in front of me with 14 items. And I know he's got 14 items because I've counted the freaking things. And doesn't he understand how important I am? I'll be patient and virtue and go, oh, well, you know, everyone's deserved. And then, but other times I'll crack the shit and start telling him that he's got 14 items, he should be in the other aisle over there. But ultimately it's me trying to run the show of life. And I don't understand that that's what I'm doing. I'm always in collision course with other people and I don't understand why. Because guess what? They don't like to be controlled like I don't like to be controlled. And so I start to get convinced that all I've been trying to do is to get all you people to do what I want to do and then my life's going to be okay. I've done it with family, I've done it with you know, my partners, I've done it with my kids. If only my kids would live up to my expectations, I'm going to be okay. And sometimes I'm kind about it, go, oh, you're doing a really good job. And other times it's like, what the freaking hell are you doing? Like, but ultimately, all I'm trying to do is get my own way. Because my kids are a reflection on me. And if they're not doing well, it's going to reflect badly on me. So ultimately, it's all about what I can snatch out of life. And I've lived my whole life like that. And so I've got to be convinced that me running the show is not working. And the only way I've found to do it is, and it's funny, you know, nowadays sometimes when I'm out there and life's not going too well and I'm trying to, it just can't, you're a freaking actor again, Chris, what are you doing? Just let God run the show. Make sense?
Yeah.
So what usually happens is the show don't come off. People won't do what I want them to do. I begin to think that life doesn't treat me right. I decide to exert myself more. That's the answer, isn't it? I've just got to go harder at it, or work harder, or, you know, try and manipulate people better. And so I try harder. And on the next occasion, I become still more demanding or gracious as the case may be. Still, the play does not suit me. Admitting that I may be somewhat at fault, I don't know about that. I used to blame everybody else. I'm sure that other people are more to blame. So it's all your fault. You know, I come in here blaming everybody else for my life. It was all your fault. It was my old man's fault. He didn't treat me the way he should have. It was my mum's fault for dying out there. She died when I was 17. It was my wife's fault. She's a freaking nagging bitch. Whatever, I blame everybody else for the way I was. See how I'm the actor again? If only they would treat me the way I think they should treat me, I'd be okay. But that's not the case. And so I blamed everybody else. He becomes angry, indignant, self-pitying. What is his basic trouble? Is he not really a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? You know, how many times have you tried to get someone to like you and you'll bend over backwards for them and they ask you to do something and you don't really want to do it, but you say yes anyway because you desperately so want them to like you. I think you used a good analogy, Pete. What was that little dog in the cartoons that go, what can I do for you? What can I do for you? You know, because he wanted desperately for the big dog to like him. And you know, I start to see that that's how I live life. I'm either going to be real mean to you, or I'm going to bend over backwards to try and please you. So that ultimately it's the same thing. I want you to like me. Is he not the victim of the delusion he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world, be only managed as well? Is it not evident to the rest of the player that these are the things he wants? And do not his actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Is not even his best moments the producer of confusion rather than harmony? You know, I started to understand this stuff about snatching all I can out of the show. And don't you understand what it is that I want? You know, can't you read my mind? And I start to understand that this is the stuff that blocks me off from other people, and we'll get to see that in step four. But this is all a lead up to step four, really. It's start to show me that how I'm trying to control you, I'm trying to get my own man no matter what. It's really a selfish and self-centred way of living life, because all I want is to snatch all I can out of life. I don't really give a shit about anybody else. And I'm an extreme example of self-will where I'm right, though I usually don't think so. And so I start to really identify with, you know, that I'm the director, the actor, the lights. I want to be everything. I want to rearrange life so that it suits me, and then I'm going to be okay. But what happens even when the show comes off exactly how it wants, I'm a chronic malcontent, and I'm still not happy. It doesn't matter when everything goes the right way, I'll still find problems, or I'll still worry about stuff. So I'm just a producer of confusion, not harmony. And, you know, look at your life. Look at your family life. You know, was it a pleasant place to be in, or was it just a confused lot of people because they don't know what they're going to get with me, whether I'm, you know, kind and considerate, or whether I'm, you know, egotistical and a nutcase. And so it just causes chaos. So our actors are self-centred, egos, Well, I'm a self-centred, egocentric, as people like to call it now. I'm like the retired businessman who lolls on the fire of sunshine in the winter complaining at the sad state of the nation. I sit there and go, yeah, look what's going on over there. I'm okay. The minister of size over the sins of the 20th century, politicians reform for sure, all would be utopia if the rest of the world would only behave. If everybody else would behave the way I wanted to, my life would just be fine. And the alcoholic who's lost all is locked up. Whatever our protestations are most of us concerned about ourselves, our resentments or our self-pity. You know, who can say no to that? And so that's the first requirement for step three, is I've got to be convinced of that stuff. If I'm not convinced of that stuff, you know, it's pretty hard to take step three. If I still think that I have some kind of control over that, which means that I have the power, and Peter, you know, emphasised that before, lack of power is my dilemma. If I think I've got power, why do I need a power greater than me? If I think that I have the power to control others and to get these people to do and life to suit me, why would I need a power greater than me? And if it works, why am I sitting here? If that life worked, why would I need to be here? I don't need to be here. Thanks. Bye. Thanks for the information. I'll just go on doing what I'm doing. So I have to be convinced of that stuff. So the next bit's going to tell me, you know, the root of my problems. And I remember reading through this next couple of paragraphs and really kind of understanding, but not kind of not understanding it. And it wasn't until I did step four and then looked back on this stuff I started to understand what it is that they're talking about, because they're going to address all this stuff in step four. It's this selfishness and self-centeredness that we think is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Who can say that happens to them? How many toes have I stood on over the years and wonder why people retaliate? But it doesn't matter, because it's your fault. I can stand on your toes and you're not allowed to retaliate. You know, how many times have I, you know, pissed off people and annoyed the crap out of people and done stuff that I'm not proud of and stood on, you know, my wife's toes lots of times and wonder why they retaliate. But I don't see that, because I'm so full of selfishness and self-centeredness. You know, it's their fault. It's much easier to blame somebody else than look at yourself, isn't it? I find it much easier to blame all you guys than actually have a deep look at yourself, because it's easy. If you're the problem, I don't have to do anything. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that sometime in the past we've made decisions based on self which later placed us in the position to be harmed. And it's, you know, I get to see the truth of that in step four, how I've made decisions, selfish decisions based on me, but now I'm getting hurt and I wonder why. You know, I made decisions based on self around my father and brother and try to snatch all I can out of life and wonder why they're hurting me now. Because I don't see that I've done that. I don't see that it was all about me and that I've stood on their toes. So, and again, I understood that more when I start to look at that inventory, and I start to look at the columns in the inventory, and I start to see how I've made decisions based on self. So we might come back and have a look at that when we're doing the four-step inventory, and have a look at that, and you'll start to see how you've stood on people's toes, and you want to keep blaming them. But ultimately you'll start to see that it's the decisions that you've made, or I've made. So my troubles, I think, are basically of my own making. They arise out of me, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-rim run right, though I usually don't think so. An extreme example of self-rim run right, you know, we're like tornadoes through people's lives. You know, trying to snatch all I can out of life and wonder why, you know, I cause people not to invite me back to places, and why I come up with friction against people all the time. I wonder why my friends drop off, because, you know, they see it but I can't see it. Above else, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. So my friend Tom said that's the first death threat in the big book. We've got to get rid of it, or it's going to kill us. You know, it's going to kill me. It kills my my spirit, it kills my association with the human race, and we heard about that in step one. When I feel I'm left out and alone and get into that state of restlessness and discontent, what's my solution? Drink will fix it. Then I'll show them. I was always going to show them. I don't know who them were, but I was going to show them. It says God makes that possible, and there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. And so, you know, they're saying selfishness is obviously going to kill me. I can't get rid of it. Lack of power is my dilemma. So ultimately, the only way I'm going to get rid of this stuff is through the aid of God or high power or whatever you want to call it. But there's 25 other different names that Bill used to call it. The only way I can get rid of that is through... If lack of power is my dilemma, lack of power is my dilemma in everything. I have no power to change that shit. It says if a mere... many of us have moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them if we would like to. It's lack of power. It says it in We're Agnostics, you know, if a mere code of morals and was sufficient to overcome alcoholism, I would have recovered a long time ago because I just live up to them. I know the difference between right and wrong and good and bad, but my moral compass gets skewed and I can't, you know. I remember a sponsor saying to me one day, oh, you think you've got power, do you? Okay, tomorrow I want you to spend the whole day and don't get angry. Not a problem, I can do that. I think I lasted 5 minutes walking out the door. And I started to see lack of power, how lack of power plays a big part in my life, that I have no power over that stuff. I know. All it does is cement home and squash home that I need to find a power greater than me. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying out on my power. I had to have God's help. So, requirement, be convinced that my life run on self hasn't been successful. I start to understand that selfishness and self-centeredness driven by 100 forms of fears has been my dilemma. Again, they're hammering home that lack of power. I don't have the power to bring about this stuff. Now it's going to tell me the how and why. I used to laugh. Some of the old timers used to say, I don't know how this works or why it works, but it works. And it says here, this is the how and why of it. So it's going to tell me. It says, first of all, I've got to quit playing God. So what he's referring to is this me trying to control everyone. It's just me trying to play God. All I'm doing is trying to be that director in everyone's life. And they don't like it. No one likes to be controlled. If you don't think that's true, go and try and control someone and see what they act and behave. No one wants. So I've got to quit playing God. I've got to let God do his job. Why do I have to quit playing God? Because it don't work. And the evidence... Again, Pete said it's an evidence-based thing. The evidence is right in front of me of how it hasn't worked. Because if it had worked, I wouldn't have found me right away, eh? If playing God worked, I wouldn't be here. I would just keep playing God. So that's the how and why of it. And then, it says... Next, we decided. So... We decided, that sound like a decision? Hereafter in the drama of life. So he's going to give us some simple terms, if you like, to make it easier for yourself. Because, you know, if I'm going to decide to turn my will and my life over something, you know, if I'm suspicious, if I am willing to believe, I need something simple. Yeah, I don't want to. I had this idea of the big man in the sky with the beard, you know, keeping score. I had to get rid of that and dumb it down. Dumb it down, okay? And Bill gives us some really dumbed down versions, if you like. He said, next, in the drama of life, God was going to be our director. That's the first dumbed down version of it. Okay, I'll just stop being the actor and let whatever it is be the director. I'll just follow his directions. Even I can understand that. I don't have to, you know, come up with this philosophical thing of what God is. Just he can be the director of my life now, whatever that is. You know, I'll follow direction. Maybe follow what all yous are doing. Maybe that might work for me. Follow the directions that you guys are taking. He is the principal, we're his agents. You know, I'm an agent for somebody. I'm going to follow directions from that principal. Or this one, even I understand. He is the father and I'm his children. I'm one of his child. I understand that because I've got kids. You know, I'm there to protect my children. I'm there to show them the difference between right and wrong. I'm there to try and direct them in a way, safe way, so they don't get hurt or get into trouble. And all parents would understand that. That's the idea that stuck for me. So I can go with that. I'll just believe he's, you know, like a father figure to me. He's going to supply what I need to get on in life and going to look after me and going to love me unconditionally, not be that old man in the sky keeping score. I love my kids unconditionally. It doesn't matter what they do. I'm not always agree with what they do, but I love them unconditionally. And so that's what I use. I dumbed it down to that. It says, most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant path through which we pass to freedom. And that's, you know, when you hand out, that's the metaphor, if you like, that Bill's trying to get us to understand, that we're going to walk through this archway to freedom. And step one was the foundation stone. Step two was the thing that we're going to put the keystone in the arch. So most good ideas are simple. You don't have to use those ideas, but come up with a simple version that you understand. Remember we read before about, you know, don't let spiritual stuff we say in this book deter you, and ask yourself what it means to you, what your conception was. And that was the game changer in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's basically what Evie said to Bill. Choose your own conception. Well, I'm not here to jam anything, because Bill was waiting for him to say, oh yeah, the old boy's on fire, all right, I'm going to get a lecture on religious thing, and Evie didn't do that. And so you've got to pick a simple idea that works for you. So that's the decision. That's the third step decision. So a couple of things. I've got to be convinced before I can do the third step. I've got to understand that selfishness, and then I've got to make a decision, whatever that is for you guys, whatever simple thing that you can come up with. And it says once we do this, this is the result. If I sincerely do it, it says when we took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer, being all powerful. He provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. I haven't even said the prayer yet. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves and our little plans, and designed more and more to become interested in seeing what we can contribute to life. So already that thing that we read out in Spiritual talks about changing the way that we see things. Changing the way that I start to see things and go off in a different direction. It's talking about here that we start to see what I can contribute to life rather than what I'm going to snatch out of life. And so automatically things start to change. You know, so step one, start to crack the ego. Step three, I'm starting to have an experience with this and go, shit, maybe there is something here. I don't know what it is, but I'm, you know. As we felt new power flowing, as we enjoyed peace of mind, discovered we could face life as successful, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow and hereafter we were reborn. So this is all happening before we've even said the prayer. So if I can do that sincerely, and again it's based on my experience with step one and the flame throw up my ass with step one, is that I will take these actions. Because I have no other choice. All other choices have been snuffed out. I was lucky, you know, I had good sponsors over the years that have said to me, do you have any other way of, you got any other outs? And I had no other outs. I've tried lots of other different things. This is the only way that I could see. And so I was willing to believe, and then I'm going to walk through this door number two, accept spiritual health. Because I'm sick and tired of living the way I'm living. I don't want to live that way anymore. I'm sick and tired of feeling the way I'm feeling. Do you want to add to that, please?
No, I like it. I like it. So, step three, we will do tomorrow as a collective, as a group. in the handout that you've got, there are some questions around step one, step two and step three. I'd encourage you guys, if you want to have a crack at that, have a crack at that. Not now, overnight, whatever. Just bear in mind that those questions are not something that's made up. They're actually statements from the book turned into a question to probably just try and hone my understanding on those three pertinent ideas, if you like, steps one and two, and to prepare me for that third step decision that I'm asked to make, to surrender to the fact that I can no longer direct my life, because evidence has suggested that doesn't work.
Just for those questions too, guys, they're not yes or no questions.
No, they're experiential questions.
All right? It's easy to go, yep. There's no experience in that. Try and relate it to your own experience.